apparently from District 8. The one Peter went back to finish off. My fear of the career pack is minor compared to my burning thirst. Besides, they were heading away from me, and by now they too will have to rest. With the scarcity of water, they may even have had to return to the lake for refills. Maybe that is the only course for me as well. Morning brings distress. My head throbs with every beat of my heart. Simple movements send stabs of pain through my joints. I fall rather than jump from the tree. It takes several minutes for me to assemble my gear. Somewhere inside me, I know this is wrong. I should be acting with more caution, moving with more urgency. But my mind seems foggy, and forming a plan is hard. I lean back against the trunk of my tree, one finger gingerly stroking the sandpaper surface of my tongue as I assess my options. How can I get water? Return to the lake. No good. I'd never make it. Hope for rain. There's not a cloud in the sky. Keep looking. Yes, this is my only chance. But then another thought hits me, and the surge of anger that follows brings me to my senses. Haymitch. He could send me water. Press a button and have it delivered to me in a silver parachute in minutes. I know I must have sponsors, at least one or two who could afford a pint of liquid for me. Yes, it's pricey, but these people, they're made of money, and they'll be betting on me as well. Perhaps Haymitch doesn't realize how deep my need is. I say in a voice as loud as I dare, "Water!" I wait, hopefully, for a parachute to descend from the sky, but nothing is forthcoming. Something is wrong. Am I deluded about having sponsors, or has Peter's behavior made them all hang back? No, I don't believe it. There's someone out there who wants to buy me water, only Haymitch is refusing to let it go through. As my mentor, he gets to control the flow of gifts from the sponsors. I know he hates me, he's made that clear enough, but enough to let me die? From this? He can't do that, can he? If a mentor mistreats his tributes, he'll be held accountable by the viewers, by the people back in District 12. Even Haymitch wouldn't risk that, would he? Say what you will about my fellow traitors in the Hob, but I don't think they'd welcome him back there if he let me die this way. And then, where would he get his liquor? So, what? Is he trying to make me suffer for defying him? Is he directing all the sponsors toward PETA? Is he just too drunk to even notice what's going on at the moment? Somehow I don't believe that, and I don't believe he's trying to kill me off by neglect either. He has, in fact, in his own unpleasant way, genuinely been trying to prepare me for this. Then what is going on? I bury my face in my hands. There's no danger of tears now. I couldn't produce one to save my life. What is Haymitch doing? Despite my anger, hatred, and suspicions, a small voice in the back of my head whispers an answer. "Maybe he's sending you a message," it says. "A message? Saying what?" Then I know. There's only one good reason Haymitch could be withholding water from me, because he knows I've almost found it. I grit my teeth and pull myself to my feet. My backpack seems to have tripled in weight. I find a broken branch that will do for a walking stick, and I start off. The sun's beating down, even more searing than the first 2 days. I feel like an old piece of leather drying and cracking in the heat. Every step is an effort, but I refuse to stop. I refuse to sit down. If I sit, there's a good chance I won't be able to get up again, that I won't even remember my task. What easy prey I am. Any tribute, even tiny rue, could take me right now. Merely shove me over and kill me with my own knife, and I'd have little strength to resist. But if anyone is in my part of the woods, they ignore me. The truth is, I feel a million miles from another living soul. Not alone, though. No, they've surely got a camera tracking me now. I think back to the years of watching tributes starve, freeze, bleed, and dehydrate to death. Unless there's a really good fight going on somewhere, I'm being featured. My thoughts turn to Prim. It's likely she won't be watching me live, but they'll show updates at the school during lunch. For her sake, I try to look as least desperate as I can. But by afternoon, I know the end is coming. My legs are shaking, and my heart too quick. I keep forgetting exactly what I'm doing. I've stumbled repeatedly and managed to regain my feet. But when the stick slides out from under me, I finally tumble to the ground, unable to get up. I let my eyes close. I have misjudged Haymitch. He has no intention of helping me at all. This is all right, I think. This is not so bad here. The air is less hot, signifying evening's approach. There's a slight sweet scent that reminds me of lilies. My fingers stroke the smooth ground, sliding easily across the top. This is an okay place to die, I think. My fingertips make small swirling patterns in the cool, slippery earth. I love mud, I think. How many times I've tracked game with the help of its soft, readable surface. Good for bee stings, too. Mud, mud, mud. My eyes fly open, and I dig my fingers into the earth. It is mud. My nose lifts in the air. And those are lilies. Pond lilies. I crawl now through the mud, dragging myself toward the scent. 5 yards from where I fell, I crawl through a tangle of plants into a pond. Floating on the top, yellow flowers in bloom, are my beautiful lilies. It's all I can do not to plunge my face into the water and gulp down as much as I can hold. But I have just enough sense left to abstain. With trembling hands, I get out my flask and fill it with water. I add what I remember to be the right number of drops of iodine for purifying it. The half an hour of waiting is agony, but I do it. At least I think it's a half an hour, but it's certainly as long as I can stand. Slowly, easy now, I tell myself. I take one swallow and make myself wait. Then another. Over the next couple of hours, I drink the entire half gallon. Then a second. I prepare another before I retire to a tree, where I continue sipping, eating rabbit, and even indulge in one of my precious crackers. By the time the anthem plays, I feel remarkably better. There are no faces tonight, no tributes died today. Tomorrow I'll stay here, resting, camouflaging my backpack with mud, catching some of those little fish I saw as I sipped, digging up the roots of the pond lilies to make a nice meal. I snuggle down in my sleeping bag, hanging on to my water bottle for dear life, which, of course, it is. A few hours later, the stampede of feet shakes me from slumber. I look around in bewilderment. It's not yet dawn, but my stinging eyes can see it. It would be hard to miss the wall of fire descending on me. Chapter 13. My first impulse is to scramble from the tree, but I'm belted in. Somehow my fumbling fingers release the buckle and I fall to the ground in a heap, still snarled in my sleeping bag. There's no time for any kind of packing. Fortunately, my backpack and water bottle are already in the bag. I shove in the belt, hoist the bag over my shoulder, and flee. The world has transformed to flame and smoke. Burning branches crack from trees and fall in showers of sparks at my feet. All I can do is follow the others, the rabbits and deer, and I even spot a wild dog pack shooting through the woods. I trust their sense of direction because their instincts are sharper than mine. But they are much faster, flying through the underbrush so gracefully as my boots catch on roots and fallen tree limbs that there's no way I can keep a pace with them. The heat is horrible. But worse than the heat is the smoke, which threatens to suffocate me at any moment. I pull the top of my shirt up over my nose, grateful to find it soaked in sweat, and it offers a thin veil of protection. And I run, choking, my bag banging against my back, my face cut with branches that materialize from the gray haze without warning, because I know I am supposed to run. This was no tribute's campfire gone out of control, no accidental occurrence. The flames that bear down on me have an unnatural height, a uniformity that marks them as human-made, machine-made, game-maker-made. Things have been too quiet today. No deaths, perhaps no fights at all. The audience in the capital will be getting bored, claiming that these games are verging on dullness. This is the one thing the games must not do. It's not hard to follow the game maker's motivation. There is the career pack, and then there are the rest of us, probably spread far and thin across the arena. This fire is designed to flush us out, to drive us together. It may not be the most original device I've seen, but it's very, very effective. I hurtle over a burning log, not high enough. The tail end of my jacket catches on fire, and I have to stop and rip it from my body and stamp out the flames. But I don't dare leave the jacket, scorched and smoldering as it is. I take the risk of shoving it in my sleeping bag, hoping the lack of air will quell what I haven't extinguished. This is all I have, what I carry on my back, and it's little enough to survive with. In a matter of minutes, my throat and nose are burning. The coughing begins soon after, and my lungs begin to feel as if they are actually being cooked. Discomfort turns to distress, until each breath sends a searing pain through my chest. I manage to take cover under a stone outcropping just as the vomiting begins, and I lose my meager supper and whatever water has remained in my stomach. Crouching on my hands and knees, I retch until there's nothing left to come up. I know I need to keep moving, but I'm trembling and lightheaded now, gasping for air. I allow myself about a spoonful of water to rinse my mouth and spit, then take a few swallows from my bottle. You get 1 minute, I tell myself, 1 minute to rest. I take the time to reorder my supplies, wad up the sleeping bag, and messily stuff everything into the backpack. My minute's up. I know it's time to move on, but the smoke has clouded my thoughts. The swift-footed animals that were my compass have left me behind. I know I haven't been in this part of the woods before. There were no sizable rocks, like the one I'm sheltering against on my earlier travels. Where are the game makers driving me? Back to the lake? To a whole new terrain filled with new dangers? I had just found a few hours of peace at the pond when this attack began. Would there be any way I could travel parallel to the fire and work my way back there, to a source of water at least? The wall of fire must have an end, and it won't burn indefinitely. Not because the game makers couldn't keep it fueled, but because, again, that would invite accusations of boredom from the audience. If I could get back behind the fire line, I could avoid meeting up with the careers. I've just decided to try and loop back around, although it will require miles of travel away from the inferno, and then a very circuitous route back. When the first fireball blasts into the rock about 2 feet from my head, I spring out from under my ledge, energized by renewed fear. The game has taken a twist. The fire was just to get us moving. Now the audience will get to see some real fun. When I hear the next hiss, I flatten on the ground, not taking time to look. The fireball hits a tree off to my left, engulfing it in flames. To remain still is death. I'm barely on my feet before the third ball hits the ground where I was lying, sending a pillar of fire up behind me. Time loses meaning now as I frantically try to dodge the attacks. I can't see where they're being launched from, but it's not a hovercraft. The angles are not extreme enough. Probably this whole segment of the woods has been armed with precision launchers that are concealed in trees or rocks. Somewhere in a cool and spotless room, a game maker sits at a set of controls, fingers on the triggers that could end my life in a second. All that is needed is a direct hit. Whatever vague plan I had conceived regarding returning to my pond is wiped from my mind as I zigzag and dive and leap to avoid the fireballs. Each one is only the size of an apple, but packs tremendous power on contact. Every sense I have goes into overdrive as the need to survive takes over. There's no time to judge if a move is the correct one. When there's a hiss, I act or die. Something keeps me moving forward, though. A lifetime of watching the Hunger Games lets me know that certain areas of the arena are rigged for certain attacks, and that if I can just get away from this section, I might be able to move out of the reach of the launchers. I might also then fall straight into a pit of vipers, but I can't worry about that now. How long I scramble along, dodging the fireballs, I can't say, but the attacks finally begin to abate, which is good, because I'm retching again. This time, it's an acidic substance that scalds my throat and makes its way into my nose as well. I'm forced to stop as my body convulses, trying desperately to rid itself of the poisons I've been sucking in during the attack. I wait for the next hiss, the next signal to bolt. It doesn't come. The force of the retching has squeezed tears out of my stinging eyes. My clothes are drenched in sweat. Somehow, through the smoke and vomit, I pick up the scent of singed hair. My hand fumbles to my braid and finds a fireball has seared off at least 6 inches of it. Strands of blackened hair crumble in my fingers. I stare at them, fascinated by the transformation, when the hissing registers. My muscles react, only not fast enough this time. The fireball crashes into the ground at my side, but not before it skids across my right calf. Seeing my pant leg on fire sends me over the edge. I twist and scuttle backward on my hands and feet, shrieking, trying to remove myself from the horror. When I finally regain enough sense, I roll the leg back and forth on the ground, which stifles the worst of it. But then, without thinking, I rip away the remaining fabric with my bare hands. I sit on the ground, a few yards from the blaze set off by the fireball. My calf is screaming, my hands covered in red welts. I'm shaking too hard to move. If the game makers want to finish me off, now is the time. I hear Cinna's voice, carrying images of rich fabric and sparkling gems. Katniss, the girl who was on fire. What a good laugh the game makers must be having over that one. Perhaps Cinna's beautiful costumes have even brought on this particular torture for me. I know he couldn't have foreseen this, must be hurting for me because, in fact, I believe he cares about me. But all in all, maybe showing up stark naked in that chariot would have been safer for me. The attack is now over. The game makers don't want me dead, not yet anyway. Everyone knows they could destroy us all within seconds of the opening gong. The real sport of the Hunger Games is watching the tributes kill one another. Every so often, they do kill a tribute, just to remind the players they can. But mostly, they manipulate us into confronting one another face to face. Which means, if I am no longer being fired at, there is at least one other tribute close at hand. I would drag myself into a tree and take cover now if I could, but the smoke is still thick enough to kill me. I make myself stand and begin to limp away from the wall of flames that lights up the sky. It does not seem to be pursuing me any longer, except with its stinking black clouds. Another light, daylight, begins to softly emerge. Swirls of smoke catch the sunbeams. My visibility is poor. I can see maybe 15 yards in any direction. A tribute could easily be concealed from me here. I should draw my knife as a precaution, but I doubt my ability to hold it for long. The pain in my hands can in no way compete with that in my calf. I hate burns, have always hated them, even a small one gotten from pulling a pan of bread from the oven. It is the worst kind of pain to me, but I've never experienced anything like this. I'm so weary, I don't even notice I'm in the pool until I'm ankle deep. It's spring-fed, bubbling up out of a crevice in some rocks, and blissfully cool. I plunge my hands into the shallow water and feel instant relief. Isn't that what my mother always says? The first treatment for a burn is cold water, that it draws out the heat. But she means minor burns, Probably she'd recommend it for my hands, but what of my calf? Although I have not yet had the courage to examine it, I'm guessing that it's an injury in a whole different class. I lie on my stomach at the edge of the pool for a while, dangling my hands in the water, examining the little flames on my fingernails that are beginning to chip off. Good. I've had enough fire for a lifetime. I bathe the blood and ash from my face. I try to recall all I know about burns. They're common injuries in the seam where we cook and heat our homes with coal. Then there are the mine accidents. A family once brought in an unconscious young man, pleading with my mother to help him. The district doctor who's responsible for treating the miners had written him off, told the family to take him home to die. But they wouldn't accept this. He lay on our kitchen table, senseless to the world. I got a glimpse of the wound on his thigh, gaping, charred flesh, burned clear down to the bone, before I ran from the house. I went to the woods and hunted the entire day, haunted by the gruesome leg, memories of my father's death. What's funny was Prim, who's scared of her own shadow, stayed and helped. My mother says healers are born, not made. They did their best, but the man died, just like the doctor said he would. My leg is in need of attention, but I still can't look at it. What if it's as bad as the man's, and I can see my bone? Then I remember my mother saying that if a burn's severe, the victim might not even feel pain, because the nerves would be destroyed. Encouraged by this, I sit up and swing my leg in front of me. I almost faint at the sight of my calf. The flesh is a brilliant red covered with blisters. I force myself to take deep, slow breaths, feeling quite certain the cameras are on my face. I can't show weakness at this injury. Not if I want help. Pity does not get you aid. Admiration at your refusal to give in does. I cut the remains of the pant leg off at the knee and examine the injury more closely. The burned area is about the size of my hand. None of the skin is blackened. I think it's not too bad to soak. Gingerly, I stretch out my leg into the pool, propping the heel of my boot on a rock so the leather doesn't get too sodden, and sigh, because this does offer some relief. I know there are herbs, if I could find them, that would speed the healing, but I can't quite call them to mind. Water and time will probably be all I have to work with. Should I be moving on? The smoke is slowly clearing, but still too heavy to be healthy. If I do continue away from the fire, won't I be walking straight into the weapons of the careers? Besides, every time I lift my leg from the water, the pain rebounds so intensely I have to slide it back in. My hands are slightly less demanding. They can handle small breaks from the pool. So I slowly put my gear back in order. First, I fill my bottle with the pool water, treat it, and when enough time has passed, begin to rehydrate my body. After a time, I force myself to nibble on a cracker, which helps settle my stomach. I roll up my sleeping bag. Except for a few black marks, it's relatively unscathed. My jacket's another matter. Stinking and scorched, at least a foot of the back beyond repair. I cut off the damaged area, leaving me with a garment that comes just to the bottom of my ribs. But the hood's intact, and it's far better than nothing. Despite the pain, drowsiness begins to take over. I'd take to a tree and try to rest, except I'd be too easy to spot. Besides, abandoning my pool seems impossible. I neatly arrange my supplies, even settle my pack on my shoulders, but I can't seem to leave. I spot some water plants with edible roots and make a small meal with my last piece of rabbit. Sip water, watch the sun make its slow arc across the sky. Where would I go anyway that is any safer than here? I lean back on my pack, overcome by drowsiness. If the careers want me, Let them find me, I think before drifting into a stupor. Let them find me. And find me they do. It's lucky I'm ready to move on, because when I hear the feet, I have less than a minute head start. Evening has begun to fall. The moment I awake, I'm up and running, splashing across the pool, flying into the underbrush. My leg slows me down, but I sense my pursuers are not as speedy as they were before the fire either. I hear their coughs, their raspy voices calling to one another. Still, they are closing in, just like a pack of wild dogs. And so I do what I have done my whole life in such circumstances. I pick a high tree and begin to climb. If running hurt, climbing is agonizing, because it requires not only exertion, but direct contact of my hands on the tree bark. I'm fast, though, and by the time they've reached the base of my trunk, I'm 20 feet up. For a moment, we stop and survey one another. I hope they can't hear the pounding of my heart. This could be it, I think. What chance do I have against them? All 6 are there, the 5 careers and PETA. And my only consolation is they're pretty beat up, too. Even so, look at their weapons. Look at their faces, grinning and snarling at me. A sure kill above them. It seems pretty hopeless. But then, something else registers. They're bigger and stronger than I am, no doubt, but they're also heavier. There's a reason it's me and not Gale who ventures up to pluck the highest fruit or rob the most remote bird nests. I must weigh at least 50 or 60 pounds less than the smallest career. Now I smile. How's everything with you? I call down cheerfully. This takes them aback, but I know the crowd will love it. Well enough, says the boy from District 2. Yourself? It's been a bit warm for my taste, I say. I can almost hear the laughter from the capital. The air's better up here. Why don't you come on up?
Think I will, says the same boy.
Here, take this, Cato, says the girl from District 1, and she offers him the silver bow and sheath of arrows. My bow, my arrows! Just the sight of them makes me so angry I want to scream at myself, at that traitor PETA for distracting me from having them. I try to make eye contact with him now, but he seems to be intentionally avoiding my gaze as he polishes his knife with the edge of his shirt.
No, says Cato, pushing away the bow. I'll do better with my sword.
I can see the weapon, a short, heavy blade at his belt. I give Cato time to hoist himself into the tree before I begin to climb again. Gale always says I remind him of a squirrel the way I can scurry up even the slenderest limbs. Part of it's my weight, but part of it's practice. You have to know where to place your hands and feet. I'm another 30 feet in the air when I hear the crack and look down to see Cato flailing as he and a branch go down. He hits the ground hard, and I'm hoping he possibly broke his neck when he gets back to his feet, swearing like a fiend. The girl with the arrows, Glimmer, I hear someone call her. Ugh, the names the people in District 1 give their children are so ridiculous. Anyway, Glimmer scales the tree until the branches begin to crack under her feet, and then has the good sense to stop. I'm at least 80 feet high now. She tries to shoot me, and it's immediately evident that she's incompetent with a bow. One of the arrows gets lodged in the tree near me, though, and I'm able to seize it. I wave it teasingly above her head, as if this was the sole purpose of retrieving it, when actually I mean to use it if I ever get the chance. I could kill them, every one of them, if those silver weapons were in my hands. The careers regroup on the ground, and I can hear them growling conspiratorially among themselves, furious I've made them look foolish. But twilight has arrived, and their window of attack on me is closing. Finally, I hear PETA say harshly,
Oh, let her stay up there. It's not like she's going anywhere. We'll deal with her in the morning.
Well, he's right about one thing. I'm going nowhere. All the relief from the pool water has gone, leaving me to feel the full potency of my burns. I scoot down to a fork in the tree and clumsily prepare for bed. Put on my jacket, lay out my sleeping bed, belt myself in, and try to keep from moaning. The heat of the bag's too much for my leg. I cut a slash in the fabric and hang my calf out in the open air. I drizzle water on the wound, my hands. All my bravado is gone. I'm weak from pain and hunger, but can't bring myself to eat. Even if I can last the night, what will the morning bring? I stare into the foliage, trying to will myself to rest, but the burns forbid it. Birds are settling down for the night, singing lullabies to their young. Night creatures emerge. An owl hoots. The faint scent of a skunk cuts through the smoke. The eyes of some animal peer at me from the neighboring tree, a possum, maybe, catching the firelight from the career's torches. Suddenly, I'm up on one elbow. Those are no possum's eyes. I know their glassy reflection too well. In fact, those are not animal eyes at all. In the last dim rays of light, I make her out, watching me silently from between the branches. Rue. How long has she been here? The whole time, probably. Still and unobserved as the action unfolded beneath her. Perhaps she headed up her tree shortly before I did, hearing the pack was so close. For a while we hold each other's gaze. Then, without even rustling a leaf, her little hand slides into the open and points to something above my head. Chapter 14. My eyes follow the line of her finger up into the foliage above me. At first, I have no idea what she's pointing to, but then, about 15 feet up, I make out the vague shape in the dimming light. But of what? Some sort of animal. It looks about the size of a raccoon, but it hangs from the bottom of a branch, swaying ever so slightly. There's something else. Among the familiar evening sounds of the woods, my ears register a low hum. Then I know. It's a wasp nest. Fear shoots through me, but I have enough sense to keep still. After all, I don't know what kind of wasp lives there. It could be the ordinary leave us alone and we'll leave you alone type. But these are the Hunger Games, and ordinary isn't the norm. More likely they will be one of the capital's mutations. Tracker jackers. Like the Jabberjays, these killer wasps were spawned in a lab and strategically placed, like landmines, around the districts during the war. Larger than regular wasps, they have a distinctive solid gold body and a sting that raises a lump the size of a plum on contact. Most people can't tolerate more than a few stings. Some die at once. If you live, the hallucinations brought on by the venom have actually driven people to madness. And there's another thing. These wasps will hunt down anyone who disturbs their nest and attempt to kill them. That's where the tracker part of the name comes from. After the war, the capital destroyed all the nests surrounding their city, but the ones near the districts were left untouched. Another reminder of our weakness, I suppose, just like the Hunger Games. Another reason to keep inside the fence of District 12. When Gale and I come across a tracker-jacker nest, we immediately head in the opposite direction. So is that what hangs above me? I look back to Rue for help, but she's melted into her tree. Given my circumstances, I guess it doesn't matter what type of wasp nest it is. I'm wounded and trapped. Darkness has given me a brief reprieve, but by the time the sun rises, the careers will have formulated a plan to kill me. There's no way they could do otherwise, after I've made them look so stupid. That nest may be the sole option I have left. If I can drop it down on them, I may be able to escape. But I'll risk my life in the process. Of course, I'll never be able to get in close enough to the actual nest to cut it free. I'll have to saw off the branch at the trunk
and send the whole thing down. The serrated portion of my knife should be able to manage that. But can my hands? And will the vibration from the sawing raise the swarm? And what if the couriers figure out what I'm doing and move their camp? That would defeat the whole purpose. I realize that the best chance I'll have to do the sawing without drawing notice will be during the anthem. That could begin any time. I drag myself out of my bag, make sure my knife is secured in my belt, and begin to make my way up the tree. This in itself is dangerous, since the branches are becoming precariously thin, even for me. But I persevere. When I reach the limb that supports the nest, the humming becomes more distinctive. But it's still oddly subdued if these are tracker-jackers. It's the smoke, I think. It's sedated them. This was the one defense the rebels found to battle the wasps. The seal of the capital shines above me, and the anthem blares out. It's now or never, I think, and begin to saw. Blisters burst on my right hand as I awkwardly drag the knife back and forth. Once I've got a groove, the work requires less effort, but is almost more than I can handle. I grit my teeth and saw away, occasionally glancing at the sky to register that there were no deaths today. That's all right. The audience will be sated, seeing me injured and treed, and the pack below me. But the anthem's running out, and I'm only 3/4 of the way through the wood. When the music ends, the sky goes dark, and I'm forced to stop. Now what? I could probably finish off the job by sense of feel, but that may not be the smartest plan. If the wasps are too groggy, if the nest catches on its way down, if I try to escape, this could all be a deadly waste of time. Better, I think, to sneak up here at dawn and send the nest into my enemies. In the faint light of the courier's torches, I inch back down to my fork to find the best surprise I've ever had. Sitting on my sleeping bag is a small plastic pot attached to a silver parachute. My first gift from a sponsor. Haymitch must have had it sent during the anthem. The pot easily fits in the palm of my hand. What can it be? Not food, surely. I unscrew the lid, and I know by the scent that it's medicine. Cautiously, I probe the surface of the ointment. The throbbing in my fingertip vanishes. "Oh, Haymitch," I whisper. "Thank you." He has not abandoned me. Not left me to fend entirely for myself. The cost of this medicine must be astronomical. Probably not one, but many sponsors have contributed to buy this one tiny pot. To me, it is priceless. I dip 2 fingers in the jar and gently spread the balm over my calf. The effect is almost magical, erasing the pain on contact, leaving a pleasant cooling sensation behind. This is no herbal concoction that my mother grinds up out of woodland plants. It's high-tech medicine brewed up in the capital's labs. When my calf is treated, I rub a thin layer into my hands. After wrapping the pot in the parachute, I nestle it safely away in my pack. Now that the pain has eased, it's all I can do to reposition myself in my bag before I plunge into sleep. A bird perched just a few feet from me alerts me that a new day is dawning. In the gray morning light, I examine my hands. The medicine has transformed all the angry red patches to a soft baby skin pink. My leg still feels inflamed, but that burn was far deeper. I apply another coat of medicine and quietly pack up my gear. Whatever happens, I'm going to have to move and move fast. I also make myself eat a cracker and a strip of beef and drink a few cups of water. Almost nothing stayed in my stomach yesterday, and I'm already starting to feel the effects of hunger. Below me, I can see the courier pack and Peeta asleep on the ground. By her position, leaning up against the trunk of the tree, I guess Glimmer was supposed to be on guard, but fatigue overcame her. My eyes squint as they try to penetrate the tree next to me, but I can't make out Rue. Since she tipped me off, it only seems fair to warn her. Besides, If I'm going to die today, it's Rue I want to win. Even if it means a little extra food for my family, the idea of Peeta being crowned victor is unbearable. I call Rue's name in a hushed whisper, and the eyes appear, wide and alert at once. She points up to the nest again. I hold up my knife and make a sawing motion. She nods and disappears. There's a rustling in a nearby tree, then the same noise again a bit farther off. I realize she's leaping from tree to tree. It's all I can do not to laugh out loud. Is this what she showed the game makers? I imagine her flying around the training equipment, never touching the floor. She should have gotten at least a 10. Rosy streaks are breaking through in the east. I can't afford to wait any longer. Compared to the agony of last night's climb, this one is a cinch. At the tree limb that holds the nest, I position the knife in the groove, and I'm about to draw the teeth across the wood when I see something moving. There, on the nest, the bright gold gleam of a tracker-jacker lazily making its way across the papery gray surface. No question, it's acting a little subdued, but the wasp is up and moving, and that means the others will be out soon as well. Sweat breaks out on the palms of my hands, beading up through the ointment, and I do my best to pat them dry on my shirt. If I don't get through this branch in a matter of seconds, the entire swarm could emerge and attack me. There's no sense in putting it off. I take a deep breath, grip the knife handle, and bear down as hard as I can. Back, forth, back, forth. The tracker-jackers begin to buzz, and I hear them coming out. Back, forth, back, forth. A stabbing pain shoots through my knee, and I know one has found me and the others will be honing in. Back, forth, back, forth. And just as the knife cuts through, I shove the end of the branch as far away from me as I can. It crashes down through the lower branches, snagging temporarily on a few, but then twisting free until it smashes with a thud on the ground. The nest bursts open like an egg, and a furious swarm of tracker-jackers takes to the air. I feel a second sting on the cheek, a third on my neck, and their venom almost immediately makes me woozy. I cling to the tree with one arm while I rip the barbed stingers out of my flesh. Fortunately, only these three tracker-jackers had identified me before the nest went down. The rest of the insects have targeted their enemies on the ground. It's mayhem. The careers have woken to a full-scale tracker-jacker attack. Peeta and a few others have the sense to drop everything and bolt. I can hear cries of, "To the lake! To the lake!" And know they hope to evade the wasps by taking to the water. It must be close if they think they can outdistance the furious insects. Glimmer and another girl, the one from District 4, are not so lucky. They receive multiple stings before they're even out of my view. Glimmer appears to go completely mad, shrieking and trying to bat the wasps off with her bow, which is pointless. She calls to the others for help, but of course no one returns. The girl from District 4 staggers out of sight, although I wouldn't bet on her making it to the lake. I watch Glimmer fall, twitch hysterically around on the ground for a few minutes, and then go still. The nest is nothing but an empty shell. The wasps have vanished in pursuit of the others. I don't think they'll return, but I don't want to risk it. I scamper down the tree and hit the ground running in the opposite direction of the lake. The poison from the stingers makes me wobbly, but I find my way back to my own little pool and submerge myself in the water, just in case any wasps are still on my trail. After about 5 minutes, I drag myself onto the rocks. People have not exaggerated the effects of the tracker-jacker stings. Actually, the one on my knee is closer to an orange than a plum in size. A foul-smelling green liquid oozes from the places where I pulled out the stingers. The swelling, the pain, the ooze. Watching Glimmer twitching to death on the ground, it's a lot to handle before the sun has even cleared the horizon. I don't want to think about what Glimmer must look like now, her body disfigured, her swollen fingers stiffening around the bow. The bow! Somewhere in my befuddled mind, one thought connects to another, and I'm on my feet, teetering through the trees, back to Glimmer. The bow!
The arrows. I must get them. I haven't heard the cannons fire yet, so perhaps Glimmer is in some sort of coma, her heart still struggling against the wasp venom. But once it stops, and the cannon signals her death, a hovercraft will move in and retrieve her body, taking the only bow and sheath of arrows I've seen out of the games for good. And I refuse to let them slip through my fingers again. I reach Glimmer just as the cannon fires. The tracker-jackers have vanished. This girl, so breathtakingly beautiful in her golden dress the night of the interviews, is unrecognizable, her features eradicated, her limbs 3 times their normal size. The stinger lumps have begun to explode, spewing putrid green liquid around her. I have to break several of what used to be her fingers with a stone to free the bow. The sheath of arrows is pinned under her back. I try to roll over her body by pulling on one arm, but the flesh disintegrates in my hands, and I fall back on the ground. Is this real, or have the hallucinations begun? I squeeze my eyes tight and try to breathe through my mouth, ordering myself not to become sick. Breakfast must stay down. It might be days before I can hunt again. A second cannon fires, and I'm guessing the girl from District 4 has just died. I hear the birds fall silent, and then one give the warning call, which means a hovercraft is about to appear. Confused, I think it's for Glimmer, although this doesn't quite make sense because I'm still in the picture, still fighting for the arrows. I lurch back onto my knees, and the trees around me begin to spin in circles. In the middle of the sky, I spot the hovercraft. I throw myself over Glimmer's body as if to protect it, but then I see the girl from District 4 being lifted into the air and vanishing. "Do this," I command myself. Clenching my jaw, I dig my hands under Glimmer's body, get a hold on what must be her ribcage, and force her onto her stomach. I can't help it. I'm hyperventilating now. The whole thing is so nightmarish, and I'm losing my grasp on what's real. I tug on the silver sheath of arrows, but it's caught on something. Her shoulder blade. Something. And finally, yank it free. I've just encircled the sheath with my arms when I hear the footsteps, several pairs, coming through the underbrush, and I realize the careers have come back. They've come back to kill me, or get their weapons, or both. But it's too late to run. I pull a slimy arrow from the sheath and try to position it on the bowstring, but instead of one string, I see 3. And the stench from the stings is so repulsive, I can't do it. I can't do it. I can't do it. I'm helpless as the first hunter crashes through the trees, spear lifted, poised to throw. The shock on Peter's face makes no sense to me. I wait for the blow. Instead, his arm drops to his side. "What are you still doing here?" he hisses at me. I stare uncomprehendingly as a trickle of water drips off a sting under his ear. His whole body starts sparkling as if he's been dipped in dew. "Are you mad?" He's prodding me with the shaft of the spear now. "Get up! Get up!" I rise, but he's still pushing at me. "What? What is going on?" He shoves me away from him hard. "Run!" he screams. "Run!" Behind him, Cato slashes his way through the brush. He's sparkling wet, too, and badly stung under one eye. I catch the gleam of sunlight on his sword and do as Peter says, holding tightly to my bow and arrows, banging into trees that appear out of nowhere, tripping and falling as I try to keep my balance, back past my pool and into unfamiliar woods. The world begins to bend in alarming ways. A butterfly balloons to the size of a house that shatters into a million stars. Trees transform to blood and splash down over my boots. Ants begin to crawl out of the blisters on my hands, and I can't shake them free. They're climbing up my arms, my neck. Someone's screaming, a long, high-pitched scream that never breaks for breath. I have a vague idea it might be me. I trip and fall into a small pit, lined with tiny orange bubbles that hum like the tracker-jacker nest. Tucking my knees up to my chin, I wait for death. Sick and disoriented, I'm able to form only one thought. Peter Mellark just saved my life. Then the ants bore into my eyes, and I black out. Chapter 15. I enter a nightmare from which I wake repeatedly, only to find a greater terror awaiting me. All the things I dread most, all the things I dread for others, manifest in such vivid detail, I can't help but believe they're real. Each time I wake, I think, at last, this is over. But it isn't. It's only the beginning of a new chapter of torture. How many ways do I watch Prim die? Relive my father's last moments, feel my own body ripped apart. This is the nature of the tracker-jacker venom, so carefully created to target the place where fear lives in your brain. When I finally do come to my senses, I lie still, waiting for the next onslaught of imagery, but eventually I accept that the poison must have finally worked its way out of my system, leaving my body racked and feeble. I'm still lying on my side, locked in the fetal position. I lift a hand to my eyes to find them sound, untouched by ants that never existed. Simply stretching out my limbs requires an enormous effort. So many parts of me hurt, it doesn't seem worthwhile taking inventory of them. Very, very slowly, I manage to sit up. I'm in a shallow hole, not filled with the humming orange bubbles of my hallucination, but with old, dead leaves. My clothing's damp, but I don't know whether pond water, dew, rain, or sweat is the cause. For a long time, all I can do is take tiny sips from my bottle and watch a beetle crawl up the side of a honeysuckle bush. How long have I been out? It was morning when I lost reason. Now it's afternoon, but the stiffness in my joints suggests more than a day has passed, even two, possibly. If so, I'll have no way of knowing which tribute survived that tracker-jacker attack. Not Glimmer or the girl from District 4, but there was the boy from District 1, both tributes from District 2, and Peter. Did they die from the stings? Certainly if they lived, their last days must have been as horrid as my own. What about Rue? She's so small, it wouldn't take much venom to do her in. But then again, the tracker-jackers would have had to catch her, and she had a good head start. A foul, rotten taste pervades my mouth, and the water has little effect on it. I drag myself over to the honeysuckle bush and pluck a flower. I gently pull the stamen through the blossom and set the drop of nectar on my tongue. The sweetness spreads through my mouth, down my throat, warming my veins with memories of summer and my home woods and Gale's presence beside me. For some reason, our discussion from that last morning comes back to me.
We could do it, you know.
What?
Leave the district. Run off. Live in the woods. You and I. We could make it.
And suddenly, I'm not thinking of Gale, but of Peter, and... Peter. He saved my life. I think. Because by the time we met up, I couldn't tell what was real and what the tracker-jacker venom had caused me to imagine. But if he did, and my instincts tell me he did, what for? Is he simply working the lover-boy angle he initiated at the interview? Or was he actually trying to protect me? And if he was, what was he doing with those careers in the first place? None of it makes sense. I wonder what Gale made of the incident for a moment, and then I push the whole thing out of my mind, because for some reason, Gale and Peter do not coexist well together in my thoughts. So I focus on the one really good thing that's happened since I landed in the arena. I have a bow and arrows. A full dozen arrows, if you count the one I retrieved in the tree. They bear no trace of the noxious green slime that came from Glimmer's body, which leads me to believe that might not have been wholly real. But they have a fair amount of dried blood on them. I can clean them later, but I do take a minute to shoot a few into a nearby tree. They are more like the weapons in the training center than my ones at home, but who cares? That I can work with. The weapons give me an entirely new perspective on the games. I know I have tough opponents left to face, but I am no longer merely prey that runs and hides or takes desperate measures. If Cato broke through the trees right now, I wouldn't flee, I'd shoot. I find I'm actually anticipating the moment with pleasure. But first, I have to get some strength back in my body. I'm very dehydrated again, and my water supply is dangerously low. The little padding I was able to put on by gorging myself during prep time in the capital is gone, plus several more pounds as well. My hip bones and ribs are more prominent than I remember them being since those awful months after my father's death. And then there are my wounds to contend with, burns, cuts, and bruises from smashing into the trees, and 3 tracker-jacker stings, which are as sore and swollen as ever. I treat my burns with the ointment and try dabbing a bit on my stings as well, but it has no effect on them. My mother knew a treatment for them, some type of leaf that could draw out the poison, but she seldom had cause to use it, and I don't even remember its name, let alone its appearance. Water first, I think. You can hunt along the way now. It's easy to see the direction I came from by the path of destruction my crazed body made through the foliage. So I walk off in the other direction, hoping my enemies still lie locked in the surreal world of tracker-jacker venom. I can't move too quickly. My joints reject any abrupt motions. But I established the slow hunter's tread I use when tracking game. Within a few minutes, I spot a rabbit and make my first kill with the bow and arrow. It's not my usual clean shot through the eye, but I'll take it. After about an hour, I find a stream, shallow but wide, and more than sufficient for my needs. The sun's hot and severe, so while I wait for my water to purify, I strip down to my underclothes and wade into the mild current. I'm filthy from head to toe. I try splashing myself, but eventually just lay down in the water for a few minutes, letting it wash off the soot and blood and skin that has started to peel off my burns. After rinsing out my clothes and hanging them on bushes to dry, I sit on the bank in the sun for a bit, untangling my hair with my fingers. My appetite returns, and I eat a cracker and a strip of beef. With a handful of moss, I polish the blood from my silver weapons. Refreshed, I treat my burns again, braid back my hair, and dress in the damp clothes, knowing the sun will dry them soon enough. Following the stream against its current seems the smartest course of action. I'm traveling uphill now, which I prefer, with a source of fresh water not only for myself but possible game. I easily take out a strange bird that must be some form of wild turkey. Anyway, it looks plenty edible to me. By late afternoon, I decide to build a small fire to cook the meat, betting that dusk will help conceal the smoke and I can quench the fire by nightfall. I clean the game, taking extra care with the bird, but there's nothing alarming about it. Once the feathers are plucked, it's no bigger than a chicken, but it's plump and firm. I've just placed the first lot over the coals when I hear the twig snap. In one motion, I turn to the sound, bringing the bow and arrow to my shoulder. There's no one there. No one I can see, anyway. Then I spot the tip of a child's boot just peeking out from behind the trunk of a tree. My shoulders relax, and I grin. She can move through the woods like a shadow. You have to give her that. How else could she have followed me? The words come out of my mouth before I can stop them. You know, they're not the only ones who can form alliances, I say. For a moment, no response. Then one of Rue's eyes edges around the trunk. You want me for an ally? Why not? You saved me with those tracker-jackers. You're smart enough to still be alive, and I can't seem to shake you anyway, I say. She blinks at me, trying to decide. You hungry?
I can see her swallow hard, her eye flickering to the meat. Come on, then. I've had 2 kills today.
Rue tentatively steps out into the open. I can fix your stings,